So welcome to another edition of the Promise Institute podcast. My name is Kate McIntosh, Executive Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights. And today I'm thrilled to be here with three very distinguished guests to discuss a paper that Richard Dicker has written as part of his residency at the Promise Institute. The paper is Time to Step Up at the ICC, No Time to Trim the Sails. So to introduce my guests, Richard Dicker wrote this paper in his capacity as Promise Institute Distinguished Fellow and Lecturer in Law at UCLA, but he's perhaps better known as the Director of Human Rights Watch's International Justice Programme, a post he's occupied since its founding in 2001. So Ambassador Michael Imran Kanu, Deputy Permanent Representative for Legal Affairs at the Permanent Mission of Sierra Leone to the United Nations in New York, where he's known to be extraordinarily active in issues of international law. Ambassador Kanu coordinates the African group at the expert level in New York on the ICC independent expert review process, as well as playing a very significant role in a number of other international negotiations around issues such as the law of the sea, the conservation and sustainable use of marine biological diversity, investor states dispute settlement under international trade, and the draft comprehensive convention on international terrorism. Also with us today, welcome Michael. Also with us today is Professor Diane Mary Amon, who is the Emily and Ernest Woodruff Chair in International Law and Faculty Co-Director of the Dean Rusk International Law Centre at the University of Georgia School of Law. A dual Irish-US citizen, she has served since 2012 as ICC Prosecutor Ben Souda's Special Advisor on Children in and Affected by Armed Conflict. And she helped research and draft the policy on children that the ICC Office of the Prosecutor published in 2016. And I should say that she's taking part in this podcast in her personal capacity. So as I said, a really distinguished group of guests. I'm absolutely delighted to have you here with us today. So Richard, you open your paper with a discussion of problems at the court and the independent expert review, which is currently underway. Can you give us a bit of background on that?
Certainly. I think there's just a very clear-cut link between some of the missteps that we've seen at the court. In chambers, certainly some very surprising and disturbing jurisprudence coming from several very important cases in the last few years, including the case against the former executive vice president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Jean-Pierre Bemba, where the appeals chamber reversed his conviction. And the problem isn't reversing a conviction. The problem was the legal logic underlying that reversal. The decision initially issued by the Afghanistan pretrial chamber denying the prosecutor's request to open investigation in Afghanistan. I'll just mention those two. I think we have seen ongoing difficulties in the office of the prosecutor, though she has made heroic efforts to correct the missteps in the first prosecutor's tenure, but nonetheless, due to a lack of staff power and excessive docket has emerged, which I believe has prevented the office from being able to apply necessary resources to advance its investigation or preliminary examinations in different country situations. So these are some of the problems.
Sorry, Richard. Is it these set of situations that led to the request for the independent expert review?
Indeed. In May of 2019, the three principal officers of the court, the president, prosecutor, and registrar, sent a letter to the president of the Assembly of States Parties, the administrative and financial governing body of the court, requesting an independent review aimed at pinpointing shortcomings that could be corrected. I think that was such a positive step and a very impressive step, but that's what set the independent expert review into motion.
Thanks. So, Michael, I see that you're playing a significant role in coordinating with that review. Can you give us an idea of what's going on there?
Now, in my role as coordinator of the African Group on this, we met in The Hague to discuss the process and some of the issues which were very important to the region which I coordinate were discussed. And for example, ensuring that the independent experts were given full access to documents and information which are necessary for them to come up with the concrete and action point resolutions, recommendation which have been invited, which the state parties have invited them to do. So essentially, our role as state parties is to ensure that we consult with the process, allow the independent experts to go through the process without hindrance, and come up with the recommendations which we hope to follow up.
Can you give us an idea, Michael, from the perspective of the African Group, what kind of things you are hoping for from the review?
So what we expected to do really is to ensure that during the information gathering stage, we're able to feed into the work of the experts. I mean, they should act independently, but we should be able to give views in terms of state parties. However, we have a challenge, and that's the challenge of inclusivity. Now, the independent experts work from The Hague, and representation in The Hague is not as high as in New York, where we have a New York working group, and most representation for the African state parties. Unfortunately, the experts were not able to travel to New York to do the consultation in person because of the COVID-19 restrictions. And so we see limitation in the number of consultation. Now, what is important is that some of the challenges which Richard has alluded to, and which perhaps, if you give me time, I would also mention controversial decisions, issue of policy step or policy or budget gap in terms of the work of the Office of the Prosecutor, the issue of sequencing peace and justice, sometimes question investigations and prosecution, overall lack of state cooperation and general poor performance and lack of transparency, are things which are important to the African state parties. Sequencing peace and justice has been an issue which led to the various, there have been various stages of interaction with the ICC from the AU perspective, overwhelming support, move towards universality. And then there was this period in which there was this move for this talk of mass withdrawal. But as we move towards a constructive engagement, what is important is that all of these issues are brought forward in the review process. So constructively, we can look at them and then have the recommendation. Unfortunately, we're having a challenge with COVID-19 and the lack of proper engagement so far. And hopefully there will be a submission to assist in this regard.
So you're concerned that important issues for the African Group, like this sequencing of peace and justice, might not get a full hearing in the independent expert review?
Well, the concern is, and this is no fault of the experts, they've done an excellent job in order to produce the interim report within the time which they've been asked to. And I must say, in the experts, it's chaired by an independent former judge. And of course, we have African experts in all of the three clusters. So really, it's not the fault of them, but it's just that due to the restrictions which we face, there haven't been opportunity for full engagement. And unfortunately, where they work from in The Hague, we don't have the full representation of African state parties. How we deal with this challenge is something which we have to look at to ensure that we have this inclusivity as we get to the recommendations.
Got it. Diane, what would you be hoping for from the independent expert review?
Well, that's quite the question. It's not clear to me what the focus of the review is, and it hadn't occurred to me that sequencing peace and justice would be part of the agenda. I guess I had understood it to be more of a efficiency expert review, perhaps with some geopolitical overlay. I think that the challenge is 20 years on to focus in a way that envisages what we would like the court to look like 20 years from now. It may well be that there ought to be structural changes in the statute. I tend to be somewhat skeptical that without serious attention to some of the processes embedded in the statute, that it will be possible to engage in reforms that address some of the issues that Richard brought forward.
What are you thinking of in particular?
He raises the issue of jurisdiction. As long as we have a court that has membership less than 100% of the states in the world, there will always be problems of the court exercising jurisdiction in a way that meets with resistance. Richard mentions that there had been proposals to allow jurisdiction on more bases than are now permitted in the statute. Were that the case, certainly that would avoid some of the geopolitical challenges that the prosecutor's office has had. I think of, for instance, the current Myanmar case. Perhaps cases like that might go forward a bit more easily. I would go so far as to suggest that considering whether a pretrial chamber is necessary and was a good idea under the statute is something worthy of review. It certainly drags out the processes by years, and a practice seems to have developed where most decisions of that three-person chamber, which is in fact a lot of people already compared to, say, a magistrate's court in most national systems, most of their controversial decisions get appealed. And so we don't see a smooth transition from the pretrial to the trial phase. We see the intervention of the appellate chamber in that process. The idea of the pretrial chamber was to streamline, to mirror the continental system of investigative judges. It's not clear to me that it's worked. It's certainly expensive. It's certainly time consuming. So those are just two things that I would throw out that if we don't look at those kinds of possible flaws in the statute and consider fully whether in fact they are flaws, I worry that a review process that takes as a given the structure will be hampered in its ability to achieve longstanding reform.
So you both in different ways suggest fairly radical reviews then. Michael, you're looking at sequencing of peace and justice, which is a pretty major policy issue for the court, and Diane talking about amendments to the statute. Is there a sense that these issues that sort of structurally significant are going to be within the purview of the independent expert review? Richard, I don't know if you have any insight.
Well, just to say very briefly, Kate, my understanding, and it may be inaccurate, is within the terms of reference, and Michael will please correct this, there is not recommendations for amendment of the Rome Statute of the ICC. I do think, however, if the findings and recommendations yield meaningful critiques and recommendations for change in certain of the structural aspects of the court, that would be an incentive and something of an inducement to consider some of the changes that Diane was just highlighting, though it is admittedly an uphill battle.
Thanks.
If I just briefly, just two important points as a follow-up. So firstly, I must say that I raise the issue of sequencing of peace and justice. when you ask the question of things of particular interest. Of course, in the AU decision as well, you can see in the summit decision in February, you see the decision on the ICC, the issue of immunities and the right of the accused were also raised. But importantly for the review, what is important is what is relevant is the terms of reference which we have in the resolution. Now, on the amendment issue, I just want to bring out that in the interim report, the experts suggested that there was sort of a binary view on this issue, whether the experts should deal with amendments or not. That could be found in paragraph 12 of the interim report. And so it appears as if there might be discussions and recommendations relating to amendment. The views on this are quite divergent, so to speak.
Oh, very interesting. Thanks, Michael. Well, let's move on to the upcoming elections, which, Richard, you spend quite some time talking about in the paper. So there are, of course, elections coming up, both for the prosecutor, the end of her 9-year term, and for three new judges. And Richard, you talk very much about how significant you consider the role of the prosecutor to be and the qualities of the ideal prosecutor. Do you want to just give us an idea of your main, the main thrust of your argument?
Sure. Well, I don't think it's up for a great deal of argument how central a role the prosecutor at this court plays, which makes the election of the next prosecutor such a significant matter. And in the paper, I try to identify three characteristics, not in opposition to others, but first and foremost, a mastery and a demonstrated history in the excellent command and practice regarding international criminal law, a firm knowledge of the Rome Statute as part of that. Number two, I think independence, which is a difficult characteristic to define, but essentially a steeled commitment to apply the statute of Rome to the work before her or his office, and to be able to withstand tremendous pressure exerted externally as well as internally. And then finally, managerial experience in really working with other criminal justice professionals that brings out the best in their work and having the ability to initiate and lead for change in institutional culture. So on my list, those are three of the essential characteristics to look for.
And you say in your paper, Richard, that you feel that Fatou Bensouda's steely independence is perhaps something that has not received enough recognition. But you push for another type of prosecutorial action, and that is the prosecutor as chief advocate, where I think you have some criticism for Bensouda. So you talk about your vision of the prosecutor really playing the public mood and a lot more strongly in order to generate state support. I'd love to hear what Diane and Michael think about that recommendation. Diane, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think I agree with Richard's trio, although it's a short list and there are probably other qualities that need to be on it. I think one of the things that is percolating around the commentariat at the moment is this notion of trying to find and elect a hero prosecutor in the mold of the old great men, if you will. I don't support that. I don't actually believe they existed. And I think that we do wrong by the system to put too much stock in any one individual. I agree with Richard that the prosecutor is the engine of the court, but she or he is also the face of thousands of other individuals. And so this notion of the one hero who can save the court, I think is something we need to stop talking about. There was a fellow named Nick Kaufman, who's a London-based lawyer, who tweeted this week that Bensouda succeeded because she was experienced, she rejected cronyism, she is modest, and she respects the views of others, including her closest advisors. We need to add that into the mix. And I wholeheartedly endorse that in some ways, the kinds of qualities that we're finding in the women leaders who are doing better by COVID in their countries than any other leaders are the things we should be thinking about with a prosecutor, that it isn't necessarily the hero. Again, that doesn't mean I disagree with anything that Richard said. You need someone who has a backbone of steel, who is willing to resist the pressure. You need someone who is a good manager. But I would add that being a good manager at the level of this person means choosing a very good chief of staff, right? That you're not going to be doing a lot of hands-on management of the many individuals. You need to know how to choose and hire and insist upon the best advisors that you can get, and then give them the power to go forward and do the management. That's probably true in all of these circumstances. We do need someone who's an inspiring world leader, a deft diplomat. But part of what we mean when we say that is someone who can set the agenda and have chosen and selected and brought into the office the high-level deputies who are going to be to implement that, because they're the ones who are going to be calling Michael and others representing states' parties to try to move that agenda along diplomatically. And so that's why I resist this idea that we're choosing one person. We're choosing a person who can bring the office together. So again, to extend my Richard's metaphor, it can be a well-working, a smoothly running engine.
That's very interesting, Diane, also in relation to the shortlist that's emerged for the prosecutor, where some of the more high-profile candidates, of course, do not feature on that shortlist. And, it's interesting to think of the way you describe the prosecutor, and maybe taking as an example some of the female leaders, as you said, who have a different leadership style. Perhaps the shortlist has something to say about not necessarily going for the high-profile hero-style prosecutor. I don't know, Michael or Richard or Diane, do you have any views on that?
If I can just share, perhaps, and even before addressing this shortlist and the discussion on that, I agree to a large extent with what has been said by Diane. Firstly, in generally agreeing with the trio of issues identified by Richard, but really to go on to say that really what you want in a prosecutor, at least from the state's perspective, is the good lawyer. You want the lawyer that the team can trust when it comes to the trust of the job of the prosecutor. I agree with Diane that management and that could be based on leadership, but also it depends on the team that you build around the prosecutor, including deputy prosecutors, which the state will also have to elect. And when Richard said the advocate issue, I think you leverage the office for good, but it doesn't mean that this should be the main point of in which you select the prosecutor. And this comes to the list. I think it's unfair a bit to those on the list when you hear talk of the highly qualified, the most highly qualified are not on the list. I think a committee was set up by the state parties with a clear terms of reference. And they've come with a list of four names on the basis of consensus. All regional groups are represented in the committee. The committee had a panel of experts. all regional groups are represented in the panel of experts. They came up with four names of highly qualified individuals in the list. I think it's a bit difficult for me to accept that there are other more qualified candidates that are not on the list, because I think we trust the process that led to the shortlist. And if we are satisfied with the qualification of those candidates of the names in the shortlist, we should be able to proceed and build a very strong team around them. We have very good lawyers there, so the first L is covered. They will provide leadership and leveraging the office for good involves not only the team, but also state parties and all those who are interested in international criminal justice.
Thanks, Michael. Well, we wait with bated breath to see who will be elected. Can we move on to the last and, you know, one of the most important points of your paper, Richard, which is about state support and how the ICC needs state support, but also how it can best go about rebuilding it. And of course, we're speaking in a context in which the United States has, you know, is launching a full frontal attack on the court. And we have seen support for the ICC in the face of that attack from a large number of states parties. But Richard, can you give us a little bit the thrust of your argument there about your idea of how the court can best go about reinvigorating and strengthening what it needs? Yeah.
Well, what I see as really the gist of the paper, I hope it comes through, is the very unique moment that the court and we as its stakeholders are at. On the one hand, there is a need for the court to step up its performance as an institution. I think that's absolutely imperative. I see that very much linked to generating and more support from a range of stakeholders, states, parties, civil society that's part and parcel of the communities most affected by the crimes the court is looking at. So improvements in performance integrally linked to building more support. I think at the same time, there's been a at best grudging attitude on a range of forms of cooperation the court requires to succeed in its mission. And that needs to change. I don't want to reduce it all down to assistance in arresting suspects. I think it goes beyond that. It struck me, and I'll stop here, that this court has faced really three existential challenges from different sources in its brief existence, the most recent from the Trump administration. And this court, because of its mandate, needs firm, active, diplomatic political backing from its state's parties, in addition to the more traditional forms of cooperation.
Well, one of the things you say in your paper, Richard, is that in order to garner that support, the court should not be more receptive to, let's say, angry states and bully tactics, but rather less. I think your phrase is no time to trim the sails. So you suggest that the court will regain or strengthen its support from the majority of states' parties if it pushes forwards on the controversial issues which it's facing at the moment, including, of course, the Afghanistan case and the pending case in Palestine. Diane, could I ask you what you think about that as a proposition?
I think the prosecutor absolutely has to continue the practice of going where the statute leads her or him. And we forget sometimes in the pushback that we've heard that there is nothing that the prosecutor has done in the Afghanistan matter that is outside the terms of the statute. The statute permits and authorizes and requires the prosecutor to look into this situation without walling off certain individuals or certain conduct, unless it is the statute itself that does that. And that's not the case. And I think that it would be a very bad road, and we would be talking about a different set of problems if the court were to start picking and choosing what it's going to look into based on ex ante assumptions about what might go forward with the least amount of pushback or criticism.
And Michael, maybe you can tell us, I mean, from the perspective of the African group, obviously there's been the criticism that the court focuses on Africa and that it has not engaged with some of the more, the major powers or the more bullying states. What difference do you think it would make to African group support if the court continues to plow ahead and takes on some of these Western nations where it has the grounds to consider that crimes have been committed? Michael, you're muted.
Sorry, let me just say that as a coordinator of the African group, it's limited to the independent expert review. And so I will give my views on the basis of a single delegation and what I've seen. So it's very clear in the AU summit decision on the ICC, reference was made to the Afghanistan situation decision then, which we felt that was really, really controversial before the appeals chamber decision. And so already there was this discussion on the politicization of the court and of course, difference in terms of how judges will deal with the situation in the interest of justice. So that's there. But when I always look at the ICC and when we refer to the ICC and the African regulation, we have to look at the steps in which and the development over time from full support to where we are now, where there's constructive engagement. But critically also how the ICC affects in a positive way the African victims. That said, the court must not be subject to a coercive measure for really executing its mandate. We have to remember that we have the ICC as a court of last resort and the, on the basis of the principle of complementarity, you know, national judicial system should be able to try those who have committed or alleged to have committed crimes of concern to the international community. The court will always step in when there's a failure or unwillingness to do so. And that should be taken into consideration. And that, therefore, that's why my delegation co-signed to a statement which was co-facilitated by Switzerland and Costa Rica to support the court and its staff and ensure that there are no coercive measures that will impede them from doing their rightful job agreed to by 123 states.
Thanks, Michael. Richard, any last thoughts on the scope of your paper and the future path for the court?
Well, just to say, I think it is a unique moment for the court and its stakeholders with this review process, with the elections coming up, with the assaults from the US administration. And I very much believe that the way forward is through improvement in performance, as well as moving to implement the mandate the drafters gave it, which was to apply justice equally to all where the statute and evidence permits. So that's my concluding thought, look forward with great anticipation to the near future.
Thank you very much. And let me just say then, thank you again to Ambassador Michael Imran Kanu and Professor Diane Marie Amon. Richard's paper, No Time to Step Up, Time to step up at the ICC, No Time to Trim the Sails, is available on the Promise Institute website. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
You can find the Promise Institute on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Be sure to check out the Promise Institute blog and sign up for our newsletter for updates on events and goings-on in the world of human rights law. Thank you for rating and reviewing the podcast. It means a lot to us and helps others find the podcast. Have a great day.